pulled back into the western portion of the Kazern. Russians probed forward with dismounted infantry to see what was happening, but without orders to renew the attack, they remained tensely in place. Soon the area was flooded with police cars, much to the bemusement of the soldiers. 20 minutes after the Americans began moving, communications were re-established with Moscow, and the Russians pulled farther back into their defensive positions. A number of unexplained bodies were found, including the regimental commander and his executive officer, plus 3 tank crews, all of whom had been killed with small arms fire. But the most important discovery was made by a Berlin policeman, who was first to examine the truck and staff car ripped apart by 25-millimeter cannon slugs from a Bradley. The Russians were all dead, but none had identity discs. The policeman immediately called for assistance, which was dispatched at once. 2 of the faces looked familiar to the cop, though he couldn't remember why.
Jack. Hi, Arnie. Grab a seat. What happened, Jack?
Ryan shook his head.
His mental state was one of giddiness. His reason told him that 60,000 people had died, but despite that, the relief at having stopped something 100 times worse had left him in a slightly drunken condition.
Not really sure yet, Arnie.
You know the important part.
The president sounds like hell.
A grunt. You ought to have heard him a couple hours ago.
He lost it, Arnie.
That bad?
Jack nodded.
That bad.
A pause.
Maybe anybody would have. Maybe you just can't expect a guy to deal with this, but that's his job, man. You know, he once told me that he was most grateful for Reagan and the others because of the changes. The fact that something like this wasn't really possible anymore.
Listen, man, as long as those goddamn things exist, it's possible.
You advocating disarmament?
Van Damme asked. Ryan looked up again. The giddiness was gone now. I got the stars out of my eyes a long time ago. What I'm saying is, if it's possible, you damned well think about it. He didn't. He didn't even look at the war games we ran. He was just so sure it would never happen. Well, it did, didn't it?
How did Liz do?
Don't ask. The boss needed good advice, and he didn't get any from her.
And you?
He didn't listen to me. And that's partly my fault, I guess.
Hey, it's over.
Jack nodded again. Yeah.
Ryan, call for you.
Jack took the phone. Ryan here? Yeah, okay.
Go slower.
He listened for several minutes, making notes. Thanks, John.
What was that?
A confession.
Is the helicopter ready?
At the pad, on the other side, one of the Secret Service men said.
The helicopter was a VH-60. Ryan climbed aboard and strapped in, along with Van Damme and 3 agents. The chopper lifted off at once. The sky was clearing. The wind was still lively, but there were stars to be seen in the west.
Where's the vice president?
Van Damme asked.
Kneecap. An agent replied. He stays up 6 more hours till we're sure this is over.
Jack didn't even hear that. He had his ear protectors in and took the chance to lean back and stare into space. The helicopter even had a bar, he saw. What a nice way to travel.
They wanted to start a nuclear war? Chavez asked.
That's what they said. Clark washed his hands.
It wasn't that bad.
He'd broken only 4 of Conti's fingers. It was the way you worked the broken bones that really mattered. Gone, they now knew his name, had taken a little more, but both stories were almost identical.
I heard it too, man, but...
Yeah. Ambitious fuckers, weren't they? Clark put some ice cubes into a bag and walked back to rest it on Conti's hand. He had his information now. And he was not a sadist. The sensible thing, he thought,
was to toss their asses out of the airplane here and now. But that wasn't his job either. Both terrorists were manacled to their seats. Clark took a chair in the back so that he could keep an eye on both. Their luggage was there also. He decided to rummage through it, now that he had the time. "Hello, Ryan," the president said from his chair. "Hi, Arnie."
"Bad day, Bob," Van Damme offered.
"Very." The man had aged. It seemed a cliché, but it was true. His skin was sallow, the eyes sitting at the bottom of dark-rimmed wells. Though he was normally a carefully groomed man, Fowler's hair was askew.
"Ryan, you have them?"
"Yes, sir. Two of our field officers grabbed them in Mexico City. Their names are Ismail Kati and Ibrahim Ghosn. You know who Kati is. We've been after that guy for a long time. He had a piece of the Beirut bombing, two aircraft incidents, lots of other things, mainly to do with Israel. Ghosn is one of his people, evidently an engineer by profession. They were somehow able to fabricate the weapon."
"Whose sponsorship?" the president asked.
Our men, that is, had to sweat that out of them." "Sir, that's a technical violation." Fowler's eyes flared into life.
"I forgive them. Get on with it."
"Sir, they say the operation was bankrolled and supported by the Ayatollah Mahmoud Haji Daryai."
"Iran?"
"Not a question, a statement." Fowler's eyes became more animated.
"Correct. As you know, Iran isn't exactly pleased with how our actions in the Gulf worked out, and..."
"Sir, according to our people, this is what they said. It was a two-part plan. Part one was the bomb in Denver. Part two was an incident in Berlin. They had another guy working with them, Gunter Bach, former Red Army faction guy. His wife was arrested by the Germans last year, and she later hanged herself. The objective, Mr. President, was to drive us and the Russians into a nuclear exchange, or at least to so screw up our relations that the situation in the Gulf would revert to chaos. That would serve Iranian interests. Or so Daryai supposedly thinks."
"How did they get the weapon?"
"They say it's Israeli." "Was Israeli," Ryan corrected himself. "Evidently it got lost in 1973. We have to check that with the Israelis, but it makes sense. The plutonium came from Savannah River, and it's probably part of the big muff they had some years back. We've long suspected that the first generation of Israeli nukes was fabricated from material obtained over here." Fowler stood.
"You're telling me that this fucking mullah did this, and killing 100,000 Americans wasn't enough? He wanted to start a nuclear war too?"
"That is the information, sir."
"Where is he?"
"As a matter of fact, Mr. President, we know quite a lot about him. He has supported several terrorist groups, as you know. He was the loudest Islamic voice against the Vatican Treaty, but he lost a lot of prestige when it started working, and that did not improve his disposition very much. Daryai lives in Qum, in Iran. His political faction is losing some of its power, and there's already been an attempt on his life."
"Is their story plausible?"
"Yes, Mr. President, it is." "You think Daryai capable of such a thing?" "On the record, sir, I would have to say that he is, yes."
"He lives in Qum?"
"Correct. It's a city with a religious history, very important to the Shia branch of Islam. I don't know the exact population, certainly more than 100,000.
"Where in Qum does he live?"
"That's the problem. He moves around a lot. He was nearly killed last year, and he learned from that. Never sleeps in the same place twice, so we hear. He stays in the same part of the city, but I can't give you a location better than plus or minus a mile or so."
"He did this?"
"So it would seem, Mr. President. That's our best data. But you can't localize him better than a mile. Yes, sir. Fowler contemplated that for a few seconds before speaking, but when he did, Ryan's blood turned to ice.
That's close enough.
President Narmanov, we have apprehended the terrorists and determined the extent of the operation.
Is this possible?
Yes, I would say so, Golovko replied. Darya is a fanatic. He loathes the Americans.
Those barbarians tried to bait us into...
Let them handle it, Golovko advised. It is they who suffer the worst losses.
You know what he will wish to do?
Yes, Comrade President, as do you. President Fowler, pending examination of the evidence, I will accept your last communication as fact. We wash our hands of this. Whatever action you feel is necessary, we will not object now or in the future. These madmen were willing to destroy us both. To hell with them.
Christ, Andruska, Ryan murmured. That's a clear statement.
The president read the message off the screen without a word. Ryan had been under the impression that Narmanov had kept control of his emotions, but now the reverse seemed to be true. Fowler sat rock steady in his chair, surveying the room with calm eyes. The world will learn a lesson from this, Fowler said. I'll make sure that nobody ever does this again. Another phone line went off.
Mr. President, FBI, sir.
Yes?
Mr. President, this is Murray. We've just had a flash from the Bundeskriminalamt. That's the German Federal Criminal Police, that they've found the body of one Gunter Bach in eastern Berlin, dressed in the uniform of a Russian army colonel. There were 9 others similarly dressed, one of whom is believed to be a former colonel in the Stasi. The data we got from Kadi and the other one is confirmed on that side, sir.
Murray, I want an opinion. Are you confident in the confessions?
Sir, generally speaking, when we bag these guys, they sing like canaries.
It's not the mafia. There's no law of omerta.
Thank you, Mr. Murray.
Fowler looked up at Ryan. Well, sounds like we got good stuff from them.
So we agree for once.
Fowler punched his SAC button. General Fremont.
Yes, Mr. President.
How quickly can you retarget a missile? I want to attack a city in Iran.
What?
I'll let Deputy Director Ryan explain.
Those sons of bitches.
Fremont spoke for everyone in the room.
Yes, General. And I intend to get the man who did this and get him in a way that will send a message that nobody will ever forget. The leader of Iran has committed an act of war against the United States of America. I intend to reply exactly in proportion to his act. I want a missile targeted on Qom. How long will that take?
10 minutes at least, sir. Let me, check with my operations people.
Sink Sack flipped off his microphone switch.
Christ.
Pete, the Deputy Chief of Staff Operations said,
the man is right. That fucker almost killed us all. Us and the Russians. For profit. For political profit.
I don't like it.
You have to retarget the bird.
I suggest a Minuteman 3 out of Minot. The 3 RVs will flatten the place. I'll need 10 minutes.
Fremont nodded.
Mr. President, you can wait.
No, I'm not going to wait. Ryan, you know what they did. You know why they did it. It was an act of war. An act of terrorism, sir. State-sponsored terrorism is war. Your own position paper from 6 years ago said that.
Jack had not known that Fowler'd read it, and being hoist on his own petard came as a surprise.
Well, yes, sir, I did say that, but that holy man did kill thousands of Americans, and tried to trick us and the Russians into killing 200 million more. He almost succeeded.
Yes, sir, that is also true, but... Fowler cut him off with a raised hand and continued to speak in the placid voice of a man whose decision had been made. It was an act of war. I will reply in kind. That's decided. I'm the president. I'm the commander-in-chief. I am the one who evaluates and acts upon the safety and security of the United States. I decide what the military of this country does. This man slaughtered thousands of our citizens and used a nuclear weapon to do it. I have decided that I will reply in kind. Under the Constitution, that is my right and my duty.
Mr. President, Van Damme spoke. The American people...
Fowler's anger appeared, but only briefly.
The American people will demand that I act. But that's not the only reason. I must act. I must reply to this, just to make sure it never happens again.
Please think it through, sir.
Arnold? I have. Ryan looked over at Pete Connors and Helen D'Agostino. Both concealed their feelings with marvelous skill. The rest of the room approved of Fowler's purpose, and Jack already knew that he was not the one to reason with the man. He looked at the clock and wondered what would come next.
Mr. President, this is General Fremont.
I'm here, General.
Sir, we have retargeted a Minuteman III missile in North Dakota for the target specified.
Sir, have you thought this through?
General, I am your commander-in-chief. Is the missile readied for launch?
Sir, the launch sequence will take about a minute from the time you give the order.
The order is given.
Sir, it's not that simple. I need an ID check. You've been briefed on the procedure, sir.
Fowler reached for his wallet and removed a plastic card, much like a credit card. On it were 10 different 8-number groups. Only Fowler knew which one he was supposed to read.
33604209. Sir, I confirm your identification code. Next, Mr. President, the order must be confirmed.
What?
Sir, the two-man rule applies. In the event of an overt attack, I can be the second man, but since that is not the case, someone on my list must confirm the order.
I have my chief of staff right here.
Sir, negative on that. The rule is that to be on the list, you must be an elected official or one approved by Congress. The Senate, that is. Like a cabinet secretary.
I'm on the list, Jack said.
Is that Dr. Ryan, DDCI?
Correct, General.
Deputy Director Ryan, this is SyncSAC, Fremont said in a voice that oddly mimicked the robotic one used to issue SAC orders.
Sir, I have received a nuclear launch order. I need you to confirm that order, but first I also need to verify your identity, sir. Could you please read your identification code?
Jack reached for his own ID card and read off his code group. Ryan could hear Fremont or one of his people flipping through the pages of a book.
Sir, I confirm your identification as Dr. John Patrick Ryan, Deputy Director of Central Intelligence.
Jack looked at Fowler. If he didn't do it, the president would just get someone else.
It really was that simple, wasn't it?
And was Fowler wrong? Was he really wrong?
It's my responsibility, Jack, Fowler said, standing at Ryan's side, resting his hand on Jack's shoulder. You're just confirming it.
Dr. Ryan, SyncSAC here. I repeat, sir, I have a nuclear launch order from the president, and I require confirmation, sir.
Ryan looked at his president, then leaned down to the microphone. He struggled for the breath to speak.
SyncSAC. This is John Patrick Ryan. I am DDCI.
Jack paused, then went on quickly.
Sir, I do not confirm this order. I repeat, General, this is not a valid launch order. Acknowledge at once.
Sir, I copy negative approval of the order.
That is correct,
Jack said, his voice growing stronger.
General, it is my duty to inform you that, in my opinion, the President is not, I repeat, not in command of his faculties. I urge you to consider that if another launch order is attempted. Jack rested his hands on the desk, took a deep breath, and snapped back erect. Fowler was slow to react, but when he did, he pressed his face against Jack's.
Ryan, I order you.
Jack's emotions exploded one last time.
To do what? To kill 100,000 people. And why? What they tried to do. What you damn near let them do.
Ryan jabbed a finger into the President's chest.
You're the one who fucked up. You're the one who took us to the edge. And now the real reason you're willing to slaughter a whole city is because you're mad. Because your pride is hurt and you want to get even. You want to show them that nobody can push you around. That's the reason, isn't it? Isn't it?
Fowler went white. Ryan lowered his voice.
You need a better reason than that to kill people. I know. I've had to do that. I have killed people. You want this man killed? We can do it. But I'm not going to help you kill 100,000 others just to take out the one man you want.
Ryan stepped back. He dropped his ID card on the desk and walked from the room.
Jesus, Chuck Timmons observed. They'd heard the entire exchange over the hot mic. Everyone in SAC headquarters had.
Yeah, Fremont said. Thank him.
But first, deactivate that missile.
The Commander-in-Chief Strategic Air Command had to think for a moment. He couldn't remember if Congress was in session or not, but that was beside the point. He ordered his communications officer to place a call to the chairman and ranking minority members of the Senate and House Armed Services Committees. When all four were online, they'd stage a conference call with the Vice President, who was still aboard Kneecap.
Jack?
Ryan turned.
Yeah, Arnie? Why?
That's why they have a two-man rule. There are 100,000 people in that city. Probably more. I can't recall how big it is. Jack looked into the cold, clear sky.
Not on my conscience.
If we need Daryai dead, there are other ways. Ryan blew smoke into the wind. And that fucker will be just as dead.
I think you were right. I want you to know that.
Jack turned. Thank you, sir. A long pause.
Where's Liz, by the way? Back in the cabin. Under sedation. She didn't cut the mustard, did she?
Arnie, today nobody did. Mainly we were lucky. You can tell the President that I'm resigning effective, Friday, I guess. Good a day as any. Someone else'll have to decide on the replacement. The President's chief of staff was quiet for a moment, then brought things back to the main issue.
You know what you've just started here, don't you?
Constitutional crisis, Arnie? Jack flipped the butt into the snow. Not my first, Arnie. Not my first. I need to ride that chopper back to Andrews.
I'll take care of it.
They'd just crossed into U.S. territory when a thought struck John Clark. Cotty's bags had those medications. One was prednisone, and another was Compazine. Prednisone was a steroid, often used to mitigate the adverse effects of... He got up from his seat and looked at Cotty. Though still blindfolded, the man was different from the most recent photos he'd seen of the man. Thinner. His hair was... The man had cancer, Clark thought. What did that mean? He got on the radio and called that information ahead. The Gulf Stream was a few minutes late getting in. Ryan was awakened on the couch in the VIP lounge on the south side of the Andrews complex. Murray was next to him, still awake. Three FBI vehicles were there. Clark, Chavez, Cotty, and Gohn were loaded into them, and the convoy of four-wheel drives headed into D.C.
What are we going to do with them? Murray asked.
I have an idea, but we need to do something first.
What, exactly?
You have an interrogation room at the Hoover Building?
No.
Buzzard's Point, the Washington Field Office, Murray said. Did your guy Mirandize them?
Yeah.
I told him he had to do that. Right before he started cutting their balls off. Ryan turned as he heard a loud noise. Kneecap was landing on the same runway 01 it had left 10 or so hours before. They must have shut down the strategic systems quicker than expected, Jack thought. The Admiral Lunan surfaced amid the flares and smoke floats dropped by the P-3. It was much too far for a rescue aircraft to come out, at least in this weather. The seas hadn't moderated and the light was bad, but Dubinin's was the only ship in the area, and he did the best he could to start rescue operations. The interrogation room was 10 by 10, with a cheap table and 5 equally cheap chairs. There was no two-way mirror. That trick had been around far too long. Instead, 2 fiber-optic cables ran out of the room and into cameras, one from a light switch and the other from what looked like a nail hole in the doorframe. Both terrorists were set in place, looking somewhat the worse for wear. The broken fingers both sported offended the professional ethic of the FBI, but Murray decided to pass on that. Clark and Chavez went off for coffee. As you see, Ryan told them, you failed. Washington is still here.
And Denver? Gone asked. I know about Denver.
Yes, you did manage to do something there, but the guilty parties have already paid.
What do you mean? Cotty asked.
I mean that Kum isn't there anymore. Your friend Daryai is now explaining his misdeeds to Allah. They were just too tired, Ryan thought. Fatigue was the worst enemy of men. Even worse than the dull pain in his hand. Cotty didn't show horror at all. His next error was worse.
You have made an enemy of all Islam. All that you have done to make peace in the region will be as nothing because of this.
Was that your objective? Ryan asked in considerable surprise, drawing on the 2 hours of sleep he'd had.
Was that what you wanted to do? Oh, my God! Your God?
Cotty spat. What of Marvin Russell? Murray asked.
We killed him. He was merely an infidel, Cotty said.
Murray looked at Gone.
This is true.
Wasn't he a guest in your camp?
He was with us for some months, yes. The fool's help was indispensable.
And you murdered him?
Yes. Along with 200,000 others.
Tell me, Jack said, isn't there a line in the Quran that goes something like, if a man shall enter your tent and eat your salt, even though he be an infidel, you will protect him?
You quote poorly. And what do you care of the Quran?
You might be surprised. Chapter 44, The Breeze of Evening. Ryan's next call was to Arnie Van Dam. He explained what he had learned.
My God, they were willing to...
Yeah, and it almost worked, Ryan said huskily. Clever, weren't they?
I'll tell him.
I have to report this, Arnie. I have to tell the Vice President.
I understand.
One more thing.
What's that?
The request he made was approved largely because no one had a better idea. After the 2 terrorists had had their hands treated, they were bedded down separately in FBI holding cells. What do you think, Dan?
It's... Christ, Jack, where are the words for something like this?
The man's got cancer, Clark said. He figures that if he has to die, why not a bunch of others? Dedicated son of a bitch, isn't he?
What are you going to do?
Murray asked. We don't have a federal death penalty statute, do we?
No.
Neither does Colorado, as a matter of fact. Murray took a moment to understand where Ryan was heading.
Oh.
Golovko had considerable trouble tracking Ryan down with his phone call. The report on his desk from Dr. Moiseev, sitting there amid all the other things, had dumbfounded him. But on learning Jack's plans, it was easy to set the rendezvous. Perhaps the only good news of the week was the rescue. The Admiral Lunin pulled into Kodiak Harbor at dawn. Alongside the pier, she offloaded her guests. Of the Maine's crew of 157, perhaps 100 had gotten off before the submarine was claimed by the sea. Dubinin and his crew had rescued 81 of them and recovered 11 bodies, one of which was Captain Harry Ricks. Professionals regarded it as an incredible feat of seamanship, though the news media failed to cover the story until the Soviet submarine had put back to sea. Among the first to call home was Ensign Ken Shaw. Joining them on the trip out of Andrews was Dr. Woodrow Lowell of the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, a bearded, bearish man, known to his friends as Red because of his hair. He'd spent 6 hours in Denver reviewing the damage patterns. "I have a question," Jack said to him. "How was it the yield estimates were so far off? That almost made us think the Russians did it."
"It was a parking lot," Lowell replied. "It was made of macadam, a mixture of gravel and asphalt. The energy from the bomb liberated various complex hydrocarbons from the upper layer of the pavement and ignited it, like a great big fuel-air explosive bomb. The water vapor there, from the snow that flashed away, caused another reaction that released more energy. What resulted was a flame front double the diameter of the nuclear fireball. Add to that the fact that snow cover reflected a lot of the energy, and you got a huge augmentation of the apparent energy released. It would have fooled anybody. Then afterwards, the pavement had another effect. It radiated residual heat very rapidly. The short version is, the energy signature was much larger than the actual yield justified." "Now, you want the real bad news?" Lowell asked.
"Okay."
"The bomb was a fizzle."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean it should have been much larger, and we don't know why. The bomb residue was lousy with tritium. The design yield was at least 10 times what it actually delivered."
"You mean..."
"Yeah. If this thing had worked..."
"We were lucky, weren't we?"
"If you want to call that luck. Yeah."
Somehow, Jack slept for most of the flight. The aircraft landed the next morning at Beersheba. Israeli military personnel met the aircraft and convoyed everyone to Jerusalem. The press had found out some of what was happening, but not enough to be a bother, not on a secure Israeli Air Force base. That would come later. Prince Ali bin Sheikh was waiting outside the VIP building.
"Your Highness."
Jack nodded to him. "Thank you for coming."
"How could I not?"
Ali handed over a newspaper. Jack scanned the headline. "I didn't think that would stay secret very long."
"It's true, then?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you stopped it?"
"Stopped it?" Ryan shrugged. "I just wouldn't."
"It was a lie, Ali.
I was lucky, I guessed." "No, that's not true. I didn't know that until later. It's just that I couldn't put my name to it, that's all."
"Your Highness, that's not important now. There are some things I have to do.
Sir, will you help us?"
"With anything, my friend."
"Ivan Emetovich," Golovko called.
And to Ali,
"Your Royal Highness, Sergei Nikolaevich,
Avi." The Russian walked up with Avi Benyakov at his side.
"Jack," John Clark said, "you guys want to get to a better spot? One mortar round sure would waste a lot of top spooks, you know."
"Come with me,"
Avi said, then led them inside. Golovko briefed them on what he had.
"The man is still alive?" Benyakov asked.
suffering all the pains of hell, but yes, for another few days. I cannot go to Damascus, Avi said.
You never told us you lost a nuke, Ryan said.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean. The press doesn't have that yet, but they will in another day or two. Avi, you never told us there was something lost out there. Do you know what that might have meant to us? Ryan asked.
We assumed that it had broken up. We tried to search for it, but...
Geology, Dr. Lowell said. The Golan Heights are volcanic. Lots of basaltic rock. Makes for a high background count. And that means it's hard to track in on a hot spot. But you still should have told us. We have some tricks at Livermore we might have used. Stuff not too many people know about.
I am sorry, but it is done, General Ben Jakob said.
You fly to Damascus, then. They used Prince Ali's plane for that, a personal Boeing 727 whose flight crew, Jack learned, was exclusively composed of former drivers from the president's wing. It was nice to travel first class. The mission was covert, and the Syrians cooperated. Representatives from the U.S., Soviet, and Saudi embassies attended a brief meeting at the Syrian Foreign Ministry, and then they went off to the hospital. He'd been a powerful man, Jack could see, but he was wasting away like dead, rotting meat. Despite the oxygen line under his nose, his skin was almost blue. All his visitors had to wear protective gear, and Ryan was careful to keep back. Ali handled the interrogation.
You know why I am here?
The man nodded.
As you hope to see Allah, you will tell me what you know.
The armored column of the 10th Armored Cavalry Regiment ran from the Negev to the border of Lebanon. Overhead was a full squadron of F-16s and another of Tomcats from the USS Theodore Roosevelt. The Syrian army was also deployed in force, though its air force was staying out of the way. The Middle East had taken its lesson on American air power. The display of force was massive and unequivocal. The word was out. Nobody would get in the way. The vehicles drove deep into the small, abused country, finally onto a valley road. The spot had been marked on the map by a dying man anxious to save what remained of his soul, and only an hour's work was needed to determine the exact location. Army engineers found the entrance and checked for booby traps, then waved the others in.
God Almighty,
Dr. Lowell said, swinging a powerful light around the darkened room. More engineers swept the room, checking for wires on the machines, and carefully checking every drawer of every table and desk before the rest were allowed farther than the door. Then Lowell went to work. There was a set of plans that he took outside to read in the light.
You know,
he said after 15 minutes of total silence,
I never really appreciated how easy this was. We've had this illusion that you really needed to...
He stopped.
Illusion. That's the right word.
What are you telling me?
It was supposed to be a 500-kiloton device.
If it had gone off right, we would have known it had to be the Russians, Jack said. No one could have stopped it. We wouldn't be here now.
Yeah. I think we have to adjust our threat estimate some.
Doc, we think we found something, an army officer said.
Dr. Lowell went inside, then returned to don protective clothing.
So large as that?
Golovko asked, staring at the plans.
Clever people. Do you know how hard it was for me to persuade the president that...
Excuse me.
I didn't, did I? If this had been a big one, I would have believed the report.
And what report is that? Golovko asked.
Can we conduct a little business?
If you wish.
You're holding someone we want, Jack said.
Lialin?
Yes.
He betrayed his country. He will suffer for it.
Sergei, first, he gave us nothing that we could use against you. That was his deal. We only got the take from Thistle, his Japanese network. Second, except for him and what he gave us, we might not be here now.
turn him loose.
In return for what?
We have an agent who told us that Narmanov was being blackmailed by your military, and that your military was using some missing tactical nuclear weapons to make it stick. That's why we suspected that the weapon might have been yours.
But that's a lie.
He was very convincing, Ryan replied. I almost believed it myself. The President and Dr. Elliot did believe it, and that's why things got so bad on us. I'll gladly hang this bastard out to dry, but it's betraying a confidence. Remember our conversation in my office, Sergei? If you want that name, you have to pay.
That man we will shoot, Golovko promised.
No, you can't.
What do you mean?
We've cut him off, and all I said was that he lied to us. If he gave us stuff that wasn't true, even in your country, it does not constitute espionage, does it? Better not to kill him. You'll understand, if we can make this deal. The first deputy chairman considered that for a moment.
You can have, Leon. 3 days. You have my word, Jack. Our man has the code name of Spinnaker. Oleg Kirillovich
Kadyshev? Kadyshev? You think you're disappointed? You ought to see it from my side.
This is the truth. No games now, Ryan.
On that, sir, you have my word of honor. I wouldn't mind seeing him shot, but he's a politician, and in this case he really didn't commit espionage, did he? Do something creative with him. Make him dog catcher somewhere, Jack suggested. Golovko nodded.
It will be done.
A pleasure doing business with you, Sergei. A shame about Leon.
What do you mean?
Golovko asked. The stuff he was giving us. Both of us. It's really too valuable to lose.
We do not do business to that degree, Ryan. But I admire your sense of humor.
Dr. Lowell emerged from the structure just then, carrying a lead bucket. What's in there?
I think it's some plutonium.
Want to take a closer look?
You could end up like our friend in Damascus.
Lowell handed the bucket to a soldier, and to the engineer commander he said, Move everything out, box it, ship it. I want to examine everything. Make sure you move everything out.
Yes, sir, the colonel said.
And the sample?
4 hours later they were in Dimona, the Israeli nuclear research facility, where there was another gamma ray spectrometer. While technicians ran the test, Lowell went over the plans again, shaking his head. To Ryan, the drawings looked like the diagram of a computer chip or something similarly incomprehensible.
It's big, clunky. Ours are less than a quarter this size. But you know how long it took us to build something of this size and yield?
Lowell looked up.
10 years. They did it in a cave in 5 months.
How's that for progress, Dr. Ryan?
I didn't know. We always figured a terrorist's device. But what went wrong?
Probably something with the tritium. We had 2 fizzles back in the '50s, helium contamination. Not too many people know about that. That's my best guess. The design needs some further looking at. We'll computer model it. But on gross examination, it looks like a fairly competent...
Oh, thank you. Lowell took the spectrometry printout from the Israeli technician. He shook his head and spoke very softly.
Savannah River, K-Reactor 1968. It was a very good year.
This is the one. You're sure?
Yeah, this is the one.
The Israelis told me the type of weapon they lost, the mass of plutonium. Except for the scraps, it's all here.
Lowell tapped the design sheets.
That's it. That's all of it, he said.
Until the next time, Lowell added. Always a student of the law and its administration,
Deputy Assistant Director Daniel E. Murray observed the proceedings with interest. Rather odd that they used priests instead of lawyers, of course, but damn if it didn't work. The trial took just a day. It was scrupulously fair and admirably swift. The sentence didn't bother Murray either. They flew to Riyadh aboard Prince Ali's aircraft, leaving the USAF transport at Beersheba. There would be no indecent haste in the administration of sentence. There had to be time for prayer and reconciliation, and no one wanted to treat this any differently from a more pedestrian case. It also gave time for people to sit and reflect, and in Ryan's case, to meet with another surprise. Prince Ali brought him in to Ryan's accommodations.
"I am Mahmoud Haji Daryai,"
the man said unnecessarily. Jack knew his face well enough from the CIA file. He also knew that the last time Daryai had spoken with an American, the ruler of Iran had been Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. "What can I do for you?" Ryan asked. Ali handled the translation for both of them.
"Is it true? What I have been told, I wish to know that it is true."
"Yes, sir, it is true."
"Why should I believe you?"
The man was approaching 70 years of age, with a deeply lined face and black, angry eyes. "Then why did you ask the question?"
"Insolence does not please me."
"Attacks against American citizens do not please me," Ryan answered.
"I had nothing to do with this. You know that."
"I do now, yes." "Will you answer a question? If they had asked for your help, would you have given it?"
"No,"
Daryai said. "Why should I believe that?"
"To slaughter so many people, even unbelievers, is a crime before God."
"Besides," Ryan added, "you know how we would react to such a thing."
"You accuse me of the ability to do such a thing."
"You accuse us of such things regularly. But in this case, you were mistaken."
"You hate me."
"I have no love for you," Jack admitted readily. "You are the enemy of my country. You have supported those who kill my fellow citizens. You have taken pleasure in the deaths of people whom you have never met.
And yet, you refused to allow your president to kill me."
"That is incorrect. I refuse to allow my president to destroy the city."
"Why?"
"If you truly think yourself a man of God, how can you ask such a question?"
"You are an unbeliever."
"Wrong. I believe, just as you do, but in a different way." "Are we so different?" "Prince Ali doesn't think so." "Does peace between us frighten you so much as that? Or do you fear gratitude more than hate?" "In any case, you asked why, and I will answer. I was asked to assist in the deaths of innocent people. I could not live with that on my conscience. It was as simple as that. Even the deaths of those I should perhaps consider unbelievers. Is that so hard for you to understand?" Prince Ali said something that he didn't bother to translate, perhaps a quote from the Quran. It sounded stylized and poetic. Whatever it was, Daryai nodded and spoke one last time to Ryan.
"I will consider this. Goodbye."
Durling settled into the chair for the first time. Arnold Van Damme sat across the room. "You handled matters well. Was there anything else we could have done?" "I suppose not." "It's today, then?"
"Right."
"Ryan's handling it?" Durling asked, looking through the summary sheets.
"Yes, it seemed the best thing to do."
"I want to see him when he gets back."
"Didn't you know?"
"He resigned." "As of today, he's out," Van Damme said.
"The hell you say?"
"He's out," Arnie reiterated. Durling shook his finger at the man. "Before you leave, you tell him that I want him in my office."
"Yes, Mr. President."
The executions were at noon on Saturday, 6 days after the bomb exploded. The people gathered. Ghosn and Kadi were led out into the market square.
they were given time to pray. It was a first for Jack, being a spectator at something like this. Murray just stood, his face set. Clark and Chavez, along with a gaggle of security personnel, were mainly watching the crowd. "It just seems so inconsequential," Ryan said as the event got underway.
"It is not. The world will learn from this," Prince Ali said solemnly. "Many will learn. This is justice happening. That is the lesson."
"Some lesson." Ryan turned to look at his companions atop the building. He'd had time to reflect, and all he saw was... what? Ryan didn't know. He'd done his job. But what had it all meant? The deaths of 60,000 people who never should have died put an end to wars that need never have been? Is that how history is made, Ali?
"All men die, Jack. Inshallah. Never again in numbers so great. You stopped it. You prevented something worse. What you did, my friend. The blessings of God go with you."
"I would have confirmed the launch order," Avi said, his voice uncomfortable in its frankness. "And then, I would have blown my brains out, perhaps. Who can say? Of this I am certain. I would not have had the courage to say no."
"Nor I," Golovko said.
Ryan said nothing as he looked back down at the square. He'd missed the first one. But that was all right. Even though Kati knew it was coming, it didn't matter. As with so many things in life, it was all controlled by reflex. A soldier prodded his side with a sword, barely enough to break the skin. Instantly, Kati's back arched, his neck extended itself in an involuntary flinch. The captain of the Saudi Special Forces already had his sword moving. He must have practiced, Jack realized a moment later, because the head was removed with a single stroke as deceptively powerful as a ballet master's. Kati's head landed a meter or so away, and then the body flopped down, blood spraying from the severed vessels. He could see the arms and legs tightening against the restraints, but that too was mere reflex. The blood pumped out in a steady rhythm as Kati's heart continued to work, striving to preserve a life already departed. Finally, that too stopped, and all that was left of Kati were separated parts and a dark stain on the ground. The Saudi captain wiped the sword clean on what looked like a bolt of silk, replaced it in the golden scabbard, and walked into a path the crowd made for him. The crowd did not exult. In fact, there was no noise at all. Perhaps a collective intake of breath, a few murmured prayers from the more devout among those present, for whose souls the prayers were offered only they and their God could say. At once those in the front row began to depart. A few from inside the crowd who'd been denied a view came to the fence line, but they stayed there for only a moment before going about their business. After the prescribed interval, the body parts would be collected and given a proper burial in accordance with the religion that each of them had defiled. Jack didn't know what emotion he was supposed to feel. He'd seen enough death. He knew that much. But these deaths did not touch his heart at all, and now he wondered and worried a little about that.
"You asked me how history is made, Jack," Ali said. "You have just seen it."
"What do you mean?"
"You do not need us to tell you," Golovko said.
"The men who started a war, or tried to, executed like criminals in the market square," Jack thought. "Not a bad precedent."
"Maybe you're right. Maybe it will make people think twice before the next time."
"That's an idea whose time has come."
"In all our countries," Ali said, "the sword is the symbol of justice. An anachronism, perhaps, from a time when men acted as men. But a sword still has a use."
"Certainly it is precise," Golovko observed.
"So, Jack,
You have fully left government service? Ali asked after a moment.
Ryan turned away from the scene, just as everyone else had done.
Yes, Your Highness. And those foolish ethics laws no longer apply? Good.
Ali turned. The Special Forces officer appeared as though by magic. The salute he gave Prince Ali was the sort to impress Kipling. The sword came next. The scabbard was wrought gold encrusted with jewels. The hilt was gold and ivory, and you could see where parts of it had been worn down by generations of strong hands. Manifestly, the weapon of a king.
This is 300 years old, Ali said, turning to Ryan. It has been carried in peace and war by my ancestors. It even has a name. Breeze of evening is the best I can do in English. It means more than that, of course.
We wish you to have it, Dr. Ryan, as a reminder of those who died, and those who did not, because of you. It has killed many times. His Majesty believes that the sword has killed enough.
Ryan took the scimitar from the prince's hand. The gold scabbard was nicked and abraded by generations of sandstorms and battles, but Ryan saw that his reflection was not so terribly distorted as he might have feared. The blade, he saw, on drawing it partway, was mirror bright, still rippled from the Damascus smith who'd shaped the steel into its fearful and effective purpose. Such a dichotomy, Ryan thought, smiling without knowing it, that something so beautiful could have so terrible a purpose. Such irony. And yet, he'd keep the sword, hang it in a place of honor, look at it from time to time, to remind himself of what it and he had done. And just, maybe, killed enough. Ryan slid the sword back into its sheath and let it fall to his side.
Yes, Your Highness. I think we all have.
Afterward. Now that the tale is told, a few things need to be made clear. All of the material in this novel relating to weapons technology and fabrication is readily available in any one of dozens of books. For reasons which I hope will be obvious to the listener, certain technical details have been altered, sacrificing plausibility in the interests of obscurity. This was done to salve my conscience, not in any reasonable expectation that it matters a damn. The Manhattan Project of World War II still represents the most remarkable congregation of scientific talent in human history, never equaled, and perhaps never to be exceeded. The vastly expensive project broke new scientific ground and produced numerous additional discoveries. Modern computer theory, for example, largely grew from bomb-related research, and the first huge mainframe computers were mainly used for bomb design. I was first bemused, then stunned, as my research revealed just how easy such a project might be today. It is generally known that nuclear secrets are not as secure as we would like. In fact, the situation is worse than even well-informed people appreciate. What required billions of dollars in the 1940s is much less expensive today. A modern personal computer has far more power and reliability than the first ENIAC, and the hydro codes which enable a computer to test and validate a weapon's design are easily duplicated. The exquisite machine tools used to fabricate parts can be had for the asking. When I asked explicitly for specifications for the very machines used at Oak Ridge and elsewhere, they arrived Federal Express the next day. Some highly specialized items designed specifically for bomb manufacture may now be found in stereo speakers. The fact of the matter is that a sufficiently wealthy individual could, over a period of from 5 to 10 years, produce a multi-stage thermonuclear device. Science is all in the public domain and allows few secrets. Delivery of such a device is child's play. I could base that statement on
extensive conversations with various police and security agencies, but it doesn't take long for a person to say, "Are you kidding?" I heard that phrase more than once. Probably no country, certainly no liberal democracy,